All right, joining us now on the Maple Toyota Hotline, our buddy from the NHL on NBC, Pierre Maguire. Happy long weekend, even though it isn't one in the U.S., Pierre. And let's start with Vegas. This, to me, is one of the greatest stories in the history of North American professional sports. Agree or disagree?
Agree, absolutely. Scott, nice to chat with you, by the way, and nice to talk with you, Bruce. Totally concur, and I think the biggest reason why is the vision of ownership with Mr. Foley and the Maloof brothers, and then obviously Murray Craven, who was kind of the conduit between the non-hockey side and the hockey side, and putting together a really good search committee to come up with George McPhee and to come up with Gerard Gallant. But the biggest thing is how they drafted their players at the expansion draft. Character, coachability, and more than anything else, speed. Mm-hmm. If you had those three ingredients, you were getting drafted by them. If you didn't have any one of the three, you weren't. They weren't taking you. It was that simple. And they've done a fantastic job implementing their vision, and that's a big part of running a successful program in the NHL today.
Pierre, when you look at this, we're like, now they're in the Stanley Cup Final. None of us, I think, have fully grasped the implications of all this, but everyone's trying to figure out what's the lesson, right? Like, what's the lesson to the league, to hockey, to whatever it is? And when you look at this Vegas team, what do you see as kind of the overarching lesson of how they've been so successful and what it means?
Well, what I just talked about, Bruce, I think more than anything else, is they had a vision and they implemented their vision. And again, coachability is a big part of this thing. They didn't just go for talented players, and there were some exposed to them. Mm-hmm. They went for guys that they thought, Pierre-Edward Belmar is a perfect example of that. How many people outside of Leksand, Sweden, Skellefteå, Sweden, Rouen, France, and Philadelphia would even know who he is?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody. Thomas Nosek, outside of people in Pardubice in the Czech Republic and Grand Rapids in Michigan, nobody would know who Thomas Nosek is. So you can go around their team. They had a plan. And more than anything else, they didn't deviate from their plan. You know, ownership didn't meddle in their plan. They had quiet confidence. And the biggest thing is they established the face of their franchise early, and it was Marc-Andre Fleury.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was there to host their season ticket holder party the night of the expansion draft. There were 14,000 people in the building when I hosted it. And you couldn't believe the thundering ovation for Marc-Andre Fleury when he came on stage. It was overwhelming. It really was.
When you look at how other general managers approached the expansion draft and the guys they lost, and some of them you can say in hindsight, oh, or you could say at the time, that was a mistake. How much of this do you think was errors by other general managers in addition to Vegas knowing what they wanted and being able to pull it together?
Combination of both. Great question, well phrased. And here's the biggest thing, Bruce. I think paralysis through overanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to one manager who will remain nameless, and he said, why are we overthinking this? I'm only going to lose one player. Why am I going to panic? I'm going to lose one player. I'm not going to lose five. Why am I going to pay them a bounty so that they don't take player A or they don't take player B? I should have enough in reserve so that it shouldn't be a problem. And I think a lot of teams either internally overhype some of their own players,
mm-hmm.
or they made miscalculations on players internally, and that happens a lot because you always overvalue your own players just because they've grown up with you. You drafted them, you cultivated them, you developed them, you signed them, all that stuff. So you develop an affinity to your own players, and you usually overhype them. But I think it's a combination of both things that you presented. But more than anything else, the teams that went into it with the philosophy is, we're only going to lose one player. We're not going to lose draft picks. We're not going to lose prospects because we want to protect other guys. If you went in with the philosophy only losing one player, you made out okay. If you went in with a philosophy, I got to protect this guy, so I'll pay a little bounty to keep him, you got yourself into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's losing two assets for the price of one, right? Like, when you could have just left one. We've seen that. We saw that across the league. And whenever we actually look at all the worst decisions from other GMs, they're exactly as you described here.
Yeah, no. I mean, listen, a couple friends of mine who run teams, would call you up and say, what do you think of this player? What do you think of that player? Do you think he'll get taken? Pittsburgh, they did it the way they knew they had to do it. They knew they were going to have cap-related issues. They knew that Matt Murray was coming up through their system. They knew they had Casey DeSmith. They knew they had Tristan Jarry. They knew they were stockpiled in goal. They didn't want to let Marc-Andre Fleury go, but they said, inevitably, that's the player we're going to lose. We know that. So we're not going to do any other deals with them. That's the player we're going to lose. That's what's going to happen. It's unfortunate, but that's what's going to happen. So they didn't touch into their reserves, which was really smart by them. You know, Mark's played great. There's no question about it. But long-term, with cap-related issues and everything else, they did the right thing.
With Pierre Maguire, and Pierre, sometimes it isn't even necessarily cap-related issues, but it is salary-related issues. Like, if I'm the Florida Panthers, right, and I feel I've overpaid Riley Smith, I've got to cough up a 30-goal score to ensure that Vegas takes Riley Smith's contract. Then Riley Smith shows up in Vegas and has himself a year and has himself a playoff.
Part of the problem is the man you were dealing with knew both sides of the deal. Gerard Gallant knew about Jonathan Marchessault, and he knew about Riley Smith. That was a big problem. He knew exactly what he was going to get out of Riley Smith, mm-hmm. and he was very, very comfortable telling George McPhee and Kelly McCrimmon, get this guy, because I'm telling you, I know how to stoke his fire. I can get him to another level, and sure enough, he has. And Riley's really thrived there. With Carlson and with Marchessault, that line's outstanding. It's outstanding. It's not a little bit good. It's really good. So, again, this is part of it. You know, again, everybody's marveling at Nate Schmidt. Nate Schmidt's not a one-trick pony that George McPhee just found on the turnip truck.
Mm-hmm.
Nate Schmidt was signed out of the University of Minnesota after playing in St. Cloud and Green Bay, in the USHL, excuse me. And then all of a sudden, Nate Schmidt is signed by Washington as an undrafted player who happened to be an All-American. So George McPhee knew everything about this player. And George was like, I'm taking this guy as a free agent because Washington's not going to sign him. You know, so again, if you look at the players, Ryan Reeves, the guy that gets the series-winning goal yesterday, how does he end up there at the trade deadline? Because Kelly McCrimmon had him with the Brandon Wheat Kings. The sense of familiarity, and it goes back to the three characteristics we talked about. If you weren't coachable, if you didn't have character, and you didn't have speed, you weren't playing for them.
With Pierre Maguire of the NHL on NBC, Scott MacArthur, Bruce Arthur on the Holiday Monday edition of Overdrive. You're listening to TSN 1050. Gerard Gallant is a coach who's been celebrated in hockey circles for a number of years now, Pierre, and a lot of people express dismay, I think quite rightly so, at the way that the Florida Panthers let him go in late November of 2016. He said something publicly last week, and again, whatever a guy says publicly, I think a lot of times we can throw it in the garbage and kind of ignore it, because it's more important what happens within the confines of a team locker room, that dynamic. But, and I'm paraphrasing here because I don't have the clip right beside me, but Gallant was asked at his daily media conference about player accountability, about players being accountable to him when they make mistakes. And he said, if you go through the tape of a 60-minute hockey game, you're going to see mistakes by both teams on each and every shift. And my focus is on ensuring that these guys play relaxed and comfortable enough that they know that if they make a mistake, hey, just go out on the next shift and do it differently, be better. And you don't hear a lot of that talk publicly from coaches, but I found that to be very progressive, and in this day and age where millennials ingest information and need to be treated differently than maybe generations before, I thought it was pretty refreshing.
Oh, absolutely, and that goes back to his time in the Quebec Major Junior League when he won a Memorial Cup, and he did some amazing things there. So, no, there's no question that that's a big part of it. I would totally concur with that, Scott. I think the biggest thing, though, with millennials in particular, they're audio learning disabled. They do better with video. And so when you show video, you don't have to talk a lot. And these guys, for whatever reason, they grasp things. Children, I'm saying, the young ones coming in the league today, they grasp things easier when they see them rather than when they hear about them. And so the less you say as a coach now, the better. It really is. Watch John Cooper tonight behind the Tampa bench. He may not even talk to his players. you know, he might talk to the referee, he might talk to his assistant coaches, but there's very little communication with his players except next guy up. That's about it. And again, he would know about this generation, and I think it's one of the reasons why some guys are thriving with the younger generations, and other guys, especially, you know, the guys that are a little bit older, have been around, they don't do as well.
Pierre, when we look on the other side of the bracket, Washington in this series, we were just talking before you got on, they look like they've been the better team in a lot of this series, not the whole of it, but a lot of it. Do you, like, it's easy to say that the ghosts are back, right? That they've managed to find a way to lose, even though that they probably should have won. Where do you see Washington right now going into Game 6?
I think there's trepidation around their team. I think there's trepidation around their building, Bruce. They have to have a lightning quick start, no pun intended. And if they don't, that's going to be a problem here. You know, it started to creep into this thing in Game 4. When their power play went a little bit helter-skelter and the fans started to boo a little bit. And it's the first time I've actually heard that in this building in a while, especially mm-hmm. in a playoff game. So that was a little bit disconcerting. The one thing I'd say is you just touched on it, which I thought was a really good point. The truth of the matter is Washington's outshot Tampa in every single game in this series. So here we are in Game 6. Tampa's not played an A game. They haven't played one game where you could say, man, that's an A game. Now, I did all of their games with the Bruins, except for Game 1, which wasn't an A game for them, but an A game for the Bruins. They played a bunch of A games in that series. They really did, including Game 2, where they were absolutely phenomenal and planted a seed of doubt for the Bruins. But I would say the big thing that worries me, it's not so much about Washington, it's that Tampa's yet to play an A game, and you got to think, at some point, they're going to play an A game. Mm-hmm. And if that's tonight, that's a problem for Washington.
Yeah. And I mean, they slayed, and I'm talking about the Caps, Pierre, they slayed the Sid Pittsburgh Dragon. And we thought, okay, I mean, and then they win the first two games on the road. And just as you were coming on, Bruce brought up the Ovi stick over the crossbar when they lost Game 4 and coughed up the two games of home ice advantage that they'd secured by winning the first two games of the series. How would you view this Washington season if it ends tonight? I mean, they accomplished a lot. They were not the favorites that they seem to have been year over year in the past, and yet you win the first two games on the road in the Eastern Conference Final. At that point, you got to be expecting to make it to the Stanley Cup Final.
Yeah, you got to be expecting, but it doesn't happen. The last team that went down 0-2 in a series and won the series in the conference final was our 91 Penguins team, and that's because we had games 3 and 4 at home. So for Tampa, if they pull this off, it's something that hasn't happened in a while. Obviously, you would expect more out of Washington because they were up 2-0 and they won the first two games in Tampa. But, Bruce, here's the one thing I would say. The fact that they're in the conference final is huge. And here are some of the losses they had to overcome. Nate Schmidt, we've already talked about him having phenomenal playoff. He would help this team a lot. Carl Alzner, I know people in Montreal would beg to differ with me. He was a tremendous Washington Capital. He fit in seamlessly here. He and John Carlson were a great tandem together. Kevin Shattenkirk was excellent on the power play here, and he took a lot of pressure off of John Carlson when he was here. And Justin Williams was an outstanding contributor to this Washington Capitals team. So they've overcome the loss of four really important players to their program, and I think Barry Trotz done a fantastic job with this team to overcome those four losses. So the fact they're in the Eastern Conference Finals has been huge. But here's the thing that excites me the most. Alexander Ovechkin has taken over this team. Yes, he's been the captain for a long time, but he cares as much or more than I've ever seen him care, and everybody is relishing his enthusiasm and his energy that he's presented to each guy on the team. He is leading by example, and he cares about the well-being of this franchise.
Well, one thing that he was asked this morning, is this the biggest game of your career? And he said, yeah, probably it is. And it probably is, because he's been in Game 7s. He's been in Game 7s against Pittsburgh. Like, I still think that they might have lost the Stanley Cup in Game 7 against Pittsburgh last year. But this game, we're talking about how Ovi is redefining himself as a player. This is a put-up game. He doesn't have to score, but he has to be an impact player in some way, doesn't he?
Completely and utterly agree, Bruce. And here are the other ones that I think have been really important. Game 7, Pittsburgh, you already touched on that, not once but a couple times. Game 7, 2010 against Montreal. Montreal won in here with 14 shots on goal in a Game 7. I did the game with Gord Miller. It was unbelievable to see how Montreal won that game. But Jaro Halak made a gigantic difference. And the quarterfinal game in the Olympics in 2010 against Canada. That was as savage a beatdown as I've ever seen in best-on-best in an international competition. Mm-hmm. I mean, Canada just savaged them, and Ovechkin was a big part of that beatdown. I'm telling you, he was. He's had a lot of big games, but this is one where I think if he stands up and delivers and the rest of the guys follow, we could be looking at a Game 7. But as I said earlier, I mean this, Scott, and I mean this, Bruce, Tampa has yet to play an A game, and they know it as a group. They know it as a group. If they do play an A game tonight, I don't even know if whatever Washington does matters.
Pierre, as you know, in these parts, we are discussing, debating any and all moves the Maple Leafs could make in the offseason to improve the spots on their roster that are so completely and totally obvious to all of us. And I think a lot of us are intrigued at the way Kyle Dubas is going to go about this and just how creative he may get. But because we're talking Washington right now, John Carlson, I would think, is the highest profile right shot defenseman who's going to hit the UFA market this summer. If he's a 7-7 guy, so 7-49-ish, if that's what it's going to take to secure him. Give me the pros and the cons of a deal like that for the Leafs or for anybody.
Well, let's start first with level of familiarity. The guy that brought him into the Ontario Hockey League was Mark Hunter with the London Knights. He would know him as well or better than anybody. So that's a positive. You're going to know your strengths and weaknesses internally right away. Number two, and this is really important, John Carlson is not a great defender. And I think everybody that does evaluation for a living knows that. But what he is he's a competent offensive player that overcomes those defensive shortcomings. You know, in game number 5 the other day down in Tampa, he had over 25 minutes on ice. He was a plus player, and he had 9 shots on goal. Yeah, there's not a lot of defensemen doing that stuff. So he's got a rocket ship for a shot. He can play with skilled players. He makes a very good first pass. I think you're being a little bit late on the money. I talked to a general manager the other day, Scott. Most guys are thinking that marketplace going closer to $8 or $9 million a year just because of what you said, the right-handed shot defensemen. There are not a lot of luxury items like that on the market. So there's going to be a premium to pay. And it'll be interesting to see who's prepared to pay that premium. I think $7 million a year is light on him.
All right, well, dinner on John Carlson then when he gets that, when he gets that new contract. Lots of traction today, Pierre. In fact, the news kind of began to trickle out just before Bruce and I got on the air. Arthur Staple, who covers the Islanders, reporting that it's just a matter of time here now. It's when, not if. Lou Lamoriello takes over as director of hockey operations. There was a report out of Quebec late last week that Lou has, in fact, met with John Tavares already, presumably as a representative of the Islanders. We sit here right now and still presume Lou to be an employee of the Maple Leafs. So who the heck knows really where it all goes? But what does this mean for the Islanders if it's true? And what effect do you perceive Lou's exodus having on the Maple Leafs front office?
I think everybody kind of knew that Lou was going to be taking a step backwards when Kyle Dubas was named general manager. That's not a knock on Kyle either or on Mark Hunter. I think what'll be interesting to see is, you know, whether they can keep Mark Hunter there or not. But again, I don't think that's a knock on Kyle. And a lot of people are prejudging Kyle. I think it's grossly unfair. He deserves an opportunity to run his team, see what he can do. He's been a part of the fabric of building the team up. They obviously had a lot of building to do. They still got a lot of building to do, but he's been part of it. That's a positive, so it's all good there. In terms of Lou, I spent a lot of time with him during the first round of the playoffs. I was surprised he wasn't back as the manager, but the fact that he wasn't back as a manager, I'm not surprised that he's back running a team. The one thing that we never heard of was whether the Islanders asked for permission. And if they did ask for permission, it's typical Lamorellian way. It never broke. It never got out. So that's pretty interesting. He'll do a lot to help the Islanders, but here's the biggest conundrum for him. You've talked about it already. What happens with John Tavares? And I think it's a stretch to say that he's going to stay. And how are they going to get a building built? Everybody's talked about the building. The problem is the state of New York still has not approved their plan to build at Belmont. That's a big issue. And they were supposed to have already broken ground on that. They have not broken ground on that. So you're looking at a minimum of 3 years. I call him Coach Lamoriello. Coach Lamoriello is 75 years old. He'll be closer to 79 if the building gets built in 3 years and they still don't have a shovel in the ground. You know, I don't know how much he's going to help them, but they got to get a building built. And if they do, then it can help them significantly.
Always good to catch up here. Thanks so much for this, and enjoy the Stanley Cup Final.
Thanks a lot, Scott. I appreciate it. Really nice visiting with you. Bruce, great talking. Will I see you at the final, Bruce?
We're going to have to see, Pierre.
Uh-oh. Okay, I got you.
Good long story, buddy.
Have a good one. Take care, boys.
See you, man.
Pierre McGuire joining us on the Maple Toyota Hotline. Maple Toyota takes away the fears of buying a pre-owned vehicle by sharing service history, lean history, and accident history. Visit MapleToyota.com.